On this week's 51%, we hear about a woman's struggle with clutter.
So I isolated myself in many ways. I mean, this is a very, very lonely disease.
Listen to an artist's rendition of Me Too and meet a fashion designer whose appearance on a reality show altered her path in a way. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I got clutter in my closet, clutter on my bed, clutter in the office, and clutter in the shed, and I can't find fun in all of this confusion. I can't take a thought, all the word.
19 million Americans are affected by hoarding, and we're going to meet one of them on the Cape of Massachusetts. Matthew Simonson brings us the story from Brewster of a woman who found help and dealt with her problems.
Mary Ann is showing me the room she moved into last October.
So this is my bedroom, and I just came in yesterday from being away.
It's maybe 10 foot by 12 foot. There's some IKEA shelving, a few framed pictures, and a twin bed.
But my bed is made, and I now have pillows, and generally there's nothing on the bed.
It's well kept, tidy, but it took a lot of work to get here. She thinks back to not so long ago, when things were at their worst.
I hadn't made a bed, and I can't tell you how long. I hadn't even changed sheets, and I can't tell you how long. And actually, I don't even know if I had sheets on my bed. I had a corner of my bed that I was living on, and the rest of it was cluttered with stuff that... You know,
Mary Ann struggles with a hoarding disorder. Now, she makes her bed every day. It's a small victory in a battle she's been fighting her entire life.
It actually started in childhood. I started collecting things when I was much younger. I'm, you know, like 5, 6, 7 years old. Paint sets, crayons, artsy, craftsy things, lots and lots of stuffed animals. And I didn't realize how important they were to me until somebody wanted to take them away. And it was like, no, you can't do that.
Mary Ann says she never outgrew her tendency to collect.
Jewelry, Southwestern items, makeup. I was a big collector of makeup. Books I had. Thousands upon thousands of books. I had a housekeeper at one time, and she was like, no, well, you've read all these books. Let's just get rid of them. And I was like, you want to throw me away? And that was literally how I took it, was she wants to throw me away. And I cried because I felt like, you know, I wasn't worth keeping.
Medical professionals recognized hoarding as a distinct disorder in 2013. Hoarding used to just be lumped under the big umbrella of obsessive-compulsive behaviors. I should note, Mary Ann didn't want to tell me her last name for a few reasons. One being that people can be less than kind when they learn about her struggles, even family and friends.
My family has always said I'm a slob and I have to clean up and how can you do this, or it's just so easy, just do it. Aren't you afraid you're gonna die of some kind of disease? You know, I won't come in your house. I don't even want to have anything cooked from you. I've had some men go, I need a woman who's a better housekeeper than you.
A part of her knew this behavior was strange, but she says that to some degree, she was more comfortable in a chaotic environment, and she became used to tuning out the mess. Still, there were consequences.
I was embarrassed to have people over my house. I often decided that because I didn't have any clean clothes or I didn't have any clothes that weren't wrinkled, I couldn't go to events. So I isolated myself in many ways. I mean, this is a very, very lonely disease.
The thing is, at the height of her accumulation, everything in her life looked fine on paper. She was successful. She had a lucrative job, 2 properties, and really nice things.
I mean, I had really beautiful furniture, but it was covered with everything. Garbage and purchases.
To avoid addressing the clutter, she threw herself into her work. 20-hour shifts, sometimes sleeping at the office. And eventually the work, the hoarding, it all got to be too much, and she hit rock bottom.
I had a breakdown, and that was a big part of why I got into recovery from this, because I couldn't keep living the way that I was.
Recovery came in the form of Clutterers Anonymous. It's a 12-step program based on Alcoholics Anonymous. They help people experiencing problems with clutter of all kinds. She called their national hotline.
And one of the first things that I heard was, choose one thing that you can do on a daily basis, like make a bed. And I made my bed. I can handle that. I can handle one thing. Okay, then I added another thing. And then I added a third thing. Now I'm getting into a routine.
Routine helped Marianne get back on track, but her house was still full. For her, standing in front of the piles,
I'm overwhelmed, literally overwhelmed by even the thought of it. I'm numb from, and I'm paralyzed just thinking about how to tackle it.
She says it took 4 months of counseling before she was ready to let go.
How often do you use it? When was the last time you used it? How many do you actually have? What brings you joy? What do you want for your future?
People in Clutter is Anonymous find questions like these helpful when deciding what to do with their things. Marianne never asked herself any of these questions before. She started with her collection of books. She enlisted the help of a friend.
I couldn't go through those books. I had to let somebody else do it for me, but that's the help of friends, you know? And in all honesty, I did end up going through those boxes and saying, hey, you, this is one of the authors I said you can't take, you know? I had to then go through all the books just to make sure that nothing else was going. And about a month later, I ended up getting rid of those books.
She got rid of more and more, recipes, hats, pet food, and eventually put what was left in storage and sold her two houses. She moved in with her sister to get help living a simpler life, chipping away at her things in storage, little by little.
I mean, I've been at this now for 4 years, and so it's been a long, hard process. And I actually went through a relapse in the middle of all of this where I got really messy again. But with each time, I've learned something more about myself and been able to let go a lot more.
So the normal routine would be to have these on the floor.
Marianne moved out of her sister's and into this modest bedroom. She's leaning over to tuck in the sheets and straighten the throw pillows.
There was a time I would just kind of like, I didn't care whether it looked good or not. When I did it, I would just kind of throw it. Now I want to have everything looking good and coordinating for my colors and stuff like that. So there's more pride in what I'm doing. And so I fluff the pillow.
She can afford a bigger room or even her own apartment, but small is exactly what she needs. She can focus here.
That seems so silly to say. I'm a 54-year-old woman who says I have to learn how to keep my room clean. But at one point, there was probably 8 months' worth of stuff in my kitchen.
Marianne knows that her recovery is a lifelong process, that staying on track means taking small steps.
So it is a big deal for me to be able to say I'm making my bed.
I fluff the pillow and I make sure that, you know, that's...
I'm doing dishes every day.
And then I put my dress pillows back up on here every day. And I want to make sure that they look good.
And I look back and it's like, I can't believe that was me at one time because I've come so far from where I was.
That's it right there.
For WCAI, I'm Matthew Simonson in Brewster.
Marianne helped start a Clutterers Anonymous group on the Cape. They meet every Wednesday morning at the Harwich Community Center. This piece came to WCAI from production partners at Atlantic Public Media through their media training program, the Transom Story Workshop in Woods Hole. Matthew Simonson is a workshop graduate. As Me Too reaches further into society with more women speaking out about sexual harassment and assault, producer Ari Golden brings us another piece from her series, A Mother's Lens. For 51%, Golden's On Me Too takes a look at the movement from the perspective of a mother who sees the collective potential through personal and cultural reckoning.
Listen close, connect, relate to change taking place in the United States through the lens of a mother.
Cathartic, loud explosion of anger and exposure. This part of the pendulum and the anger that is expressing itself, it's necessary. It's time for the light to shine on the truth. It's time! Everyone's listening.
Profile of a woman, a mother. Giving voice to everyday people like you and me.
Men be laying around at night going, oh, snap. Are they gonna call me out?
Share our stories and set them free.
There is no holding back. And now is the time. and we're creating it right now in this moment with every second that goes by. It's happening right now, right now, right now. We're writing it. How the Me Too movement is manifesting in my own daily life. So I was in a grocery store shopping and I saw a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in about 9 months. We're catching up and then we check out together at the cashier and out of nowhere for me, he says, "Oh, and by the way, your ass looks really good." It was literally in front of this older woman who was checking us out. I'm looking at her and she's looking at me. I just looked at him like a small little brother of mine and I forgave him it in my mind. I forgave a little crime. We continue. He walks me to my car. We catch up. I leave. Within an hour, I get a text from him and says, "In the age of Me Too, I want to apologize.
Accountability.
For the comment I made to you in the store. I apologize for its inappropriateness, and I'm sorry I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable." Accountability is the new sexy. And in that moment, I realized I was mad about it, but I had shoved it down and I forgave him the crime. And when he said it, I felt light and seen, acknowledged that my experience was of value to this person, and I was so grateful for the Me Too movement. By him acknowledging it,
zeitgeist,
it allowed me to feel it for what it was. It felt like truth. That part of me that I had numbed, I felt it open and free.
Free.
Our evolution as a species.
Toxic masculinity is coming apart at the seams as the pendulum swings to the extreme.
This part of the pendulum and the anger that is expressing itself, it's necessary.
Purge the rage hidden beneath the stage. Everyone is listening.
Everyone's listening.
We are reckoning, grappling, cracking open.
Anger is an important tool that we must use, revere, and respect. And we have to face it in ourselves. And we have to face it in ourselves. But it needs its place.
Dig deep into our stories and set them free through the body.
In the work that I've done with my own therapist, he really has celebrated anger as a necessary tool to get through to the sadness and the feeling. Truth. And giving it a healthy place to manifest itself in its full glory. He took me to the top of this mountain, and I had to go somewhere where no one would see me, and I would feel totally comfortable. And I had to bring a piece of furniture that was hard to break. I think it was a table I got from Goodwill that I hauled into my van. And then I had my big axe stick. It was a handle to an axe, a handle of an axe. It took me forever. And I screamed and I screamed and I screamed and I screamed and I screamed. And I broke stuff. The blood coursing through my muscles, screaming like a wild person at this mountain. I mean, and I had to blow it to smithereens. It had to be in like teeny little pieces. Purged. After that, the way I walked in the world was totally changed. And I held myself differently, and I had strong boundaries. I was in touch with that part of me that was angry. And it had to do with my father figures, my birth dad and my stepdad. Strained and angry relationship, him coming to America. When I was 7, with my mom, I was American, she was Americanized, highly combustible. Old Asian with preteen American girl living in the same house. and my birth dad and dying when I was two. It just this whole Indian saga. After I screamed till I couldn't scream anymore and hit till I was completely exhausted, I sat on the rock and tears came. And that part of me that I had numbed, I felt it open and free. Once you go through anger, it's a dam, and the tears flow deep from like my belly. You know, like deep and raw and mourning, a grieving kind of wailing. I didn't even cry for that long, but it was deep, it was fast. It felt like truth. And I heard myself say, I just want my daddy. I just wanted my daddy. And there I was, just this heartbroken little girl. And I got to like weep as that two-year-old that lost her dad. That simple and raw. It was the ultimate truth. And I felt it in my body. I felt the love. It therefore allowed me to purge unhealthy connections with male people in my life and how I viewed them. And I saw and I mourned and I grieved the loss of my daddy. And a lot of the stories I had about men and punishing men I was with, it was gone. And I feel really healthy about it all now. It cleared a lot. It's very humbling. Oh. Oh, that's what I want. You know? Oh, right. You know? And I think that's like the cosmic joke, because face the truth. What was in common with a lot of these men in power that are being exposed, I realize they're just too scared to grieve what happened to them. And they're holding up this house of, I never understood what House of Cards was. I get it now, it's a house of lies. That's so fragile, but you try so hard to keep all these lies about who you are in your life in order to not face the truth.
Accountability.
It would be a great spiritual moment in our lives to watch someone that entrenched in his own house of cards face the truth, dismantle it, and touch that small child in him. A breakthrough. And grieved what he needs to grieve so that he could connect with us all. And what would that do for us to see what we're looking at as an enemy as the little boy? I think the great healing that will come after this big pendulum swing and this cathartic, loud explosion of anger and exposure. The great rebalancing will be all of us seeing ourselves and each other. Our evolution as a species.
Listen close. Connect, relate to change taking place in the United States through the lens of a mother.
On Me Too is part of artist and producer Ari Golden's series A Mother's Lens, which explores humanity since the 2016 U.S. presidential election. It reflects on the culture shift of our times and is produced for 51%. You can find more of her work at arigolden.com. Minneapolis fashion designer Samantha Ray hit the runway in Project Runway Season 16. The national exposure has her rethinking her line. Goth glam pajamas? She'll make it work. KFAI's Diane Richard reports.
In Minneapolis, I'm Diane Richard. Minneapolis is home to a fashion warrior, Samantha Ray, who's come straight from the trenches of the latest season of Project Runway. That's a reality show where designers are given creative tasks with absurd timelines and are told to, quote, make it work.
One, go ahead.
If not, well, take it away, Heidi Klum.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to the runway. As you know, in fashion, one day you're in, and the next day, you're out.
Samantha Ray's specialty is subculture fashion. Lolita, punk, goth. Her girl is likely to wear eggplant lipstick, teal green hair, and corseted dresses, like she does.
Structured, tailoring, and whimsy. I joke that I'm Vivian Westwood meets Kate Spade, so cute with a little edge.
What did you want to get out of your time on Project Runway?
Well, I obviously wanted to win.
That didn't happen. Here are judges Heidi Klum and Nina Garcia talking to Samantha.
And the work you put into this is insane. I can see it from here.
But Samantha, I'm going to tell you the same thing that I told you last time. Did you make that dress for yourself?
I did.
Okay. You're wearing this really exciting gold dress with the leather harness. That's what I want to see. That's the showstopper.
After that, she got the show's trademark kiss-off.
Auf Wiedersehen. All the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you for this chance.
What was it like to hear Auf Wiedersehen from Heidi Klum?
It was disappointing. It was really frustrating. And in that moment, I felt so sad. But I know this is a contest, and I know there has to be a winner. I'm sad it's not me. But at least I represented myself well. I made my client happy. And at the end of the day, it's more important to make a client happy than it is to please a judge.
Which is why she's opened a studio in Northeast Minneapolis. It's all plywood floors and patched walls. It's so bare, it echoes.
It's an old scientific laboratories building, so there are all kinds of pipes and ductwork, and it looks like a lot of science used to happen here.
For the past 17 years, Samantha's designed couture clothing, one client at a time. Today, she's making plans for a national brand. Customers who saw her on the show want her grunge glam look in their lives.
And, I mean, even the challenge I did where I created sleepwear, like, I'd never done pajamas before, and I had never thought to, and I got loads of letters from fans. They're just like, put me on your mailing list. When you make a pajama line, I want it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even think to do this.
Till then, she'll keep her part-time job at the funky uptown shoe store, John Fluvog. Until she starts designing shoes, that is. She's already inspired two signature lipsticks made by Minneapolis-based Elixiri. The color? Supernova Black Purple in matte and liquid. For KFAI Radio, I'm Diane Richard.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1487.